You're listening to The Doherty Report with Elizabeth Doherty. Once again, here's Elizabeth.
Right now we're talking with Frank Wucko. He is a retired Naval Intelligence Officer and founder of U.S. Central Command Red Team. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Great to be back with you.
You too. We love having you on the show. And we're struggling with this thing going on in the Middle East right now. We know that there's a lot of very confusing things going on. Doesn't it seem a little odd to you that people are more supportive of Russia than they are of our own country right now?
In a way it does, but people in general like, you know, whether it hinges on, you know, sort of negativity or however you want to characterize the Russians, people generally like decisiveness. They like dependability. At a certain point, they like certainty. So it's sort of, you know, like dealing with the devil you know. Right now, the world doesn't know the United States anymore.
You're right.
The world doesn't recognize the United States anymore.
Why is that?
Well, it's because our national attitude or even our international attitude from our leadership has changed so drastically that people no longer recognize the United States of America. You know, whether they liked us or not. And I've been all over the world a few times, and despite what you hear here, the world is not angry. Before Obama came into office, you know, he used to say, well, the reason the world doesn't like us is this. The reason the world is upset with us is that. The world isn't upset with us, and the world doesn't, you know, as a whole, dislike the United States of America. Even those that do have come to depend on our role in the world.
That's a big thing.
And nobody knows what our role in the world is. We've completely given up on any type of, you know, decisive leadership role. So when people see that in the Russians, people see that in Putin.
Okay.
They like it. They see it as something that is predictable, dependable, and it's the devil you know.
So we have no role in the world now.
Yeah, we've largely forsaken our traditional role of leadership.
I think we sold our soul to Iran. That's what I think.
Well, what we've done is really our role in the world and our sort of activities in the world have become very personalized. And they've become very personalized around Barack Obama. So our foreign policy, our national strategy is now completely built around the way this man and his small circle of pals and friends and advisors that he has come up with over the last 4 years want to see the world. So there really has been a drastic shift from things that are generally within the U.S. interest to things that are specifically within Barack Obama's interest. And the world has just never seen, you know, American foreign policy shift so drastically.
Don't you think that's a little scary?
It's very scary.
I've never seen anything like this.
No, I don't think anybody has. And if anything, I'm not, whether it's scary or whether they're, you know, because people are afraid something horrible is going to happen, or it's just scary because things are so uncertain now. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody can predict what might happen or how we might react. That's very unsettling to people. Yeah, there's this underlying nervousness, at least here in the United States.
We don't feel safe.
People have never known before. Correct.
And that's not good. So when he made that deal with Iran, knowing people told me in the intelligence community, told me they already had nuclear weapons. They already had them.
Yeah, that I don't know. I would say that is one thing that, by and large, if you're looking.
That's what Peter Pride.
I think by now the international community is certainly looking.
Okay.
That's generally something that if you're looking, I'd say in the case of, you know, India or Pakistan, where nobody was, you know, honestly, you know, in order to collect intelligence, you know, the information doesn't come to you. You have to target the activity. You have to target the areas. You have to be looking. So we simply weren't looking at Pakistan. And that's why the kind of the intelligence community was caught off guard.
Huh.
I think there are so many resources focused on looking at what Iran's doing. The actual acquisition, the development of a nuclear weapon is something that is very hard to do under the radar. I mean, you're starting to see now, you're like somebody, you know, it's not possible for someone to build a secret nuclear weapon in their backyard or in their garage.
No, because you have to buy the actual nuclear stuff. And that organization that's supposed to investigate them.
The IAEA.
Yes. I talked to them and they said, we don't do what you're actually saying we do. We don't look at all this other stuff. We're very limited in what we can do.
Well, in order to develop the fissionable material required for, you know, weaponized.
They don't look at centrifuges or anything like that.
Well, they don't, but plenty of other people. The IAEA is not an intelligence collection organization. They're a monitoring organization. So they're monitoring activity.
Yeah.
You know, so far as they can on the ground, but we can. Other countries, the Israelis and whatnot. I mean, there's no mistaking the industrial complex required to produce that material. I mean, it's enormous. I mean, if you just see the pictures that you do see of Iran's industrial complex, nuclear industrial complex, it's got a signature. It's like an oil refinery. You can't refine oil in your garage in secret.
No,
you
can't.
It takes a massive type of complex with a certain signature on it. And the same thing goes with nuclear weapons production,
okay.
Nuclear material production. I mean, it leaves a signature. You can't hide it.
So I'm going to ask you a very not nice question. Why didn't the United States turn Iran and Syria into glass already?
I know what you're getting at. I mean,
you know what I'm getting at.
I don't think it's been our policy really to just start nuking countries. I think if we were going to have done that, my preference would have been to have dropped a couple of low-yield tactical nuclear weapons over Afghanistan the day after 9/11 to send a definite message to the world that they had screwed up in a big way.
And why does Saudi Arabia get such a free pass?
If you look at what the Israelis did with Syria,
yeah,
the Israelis were monitoring that nuclear facility very, very closely. And the Israelis have a decision point. They have a, you know, they've got a decision-making matrix that if enough boxes on it get filled up, there's a point of no return for the Israelis. And they will,
okay.
When they eliminated that site in Syria, the Syrians had crossed the point of no return, the point beyond which the Israelis, you know, could tolerate the activity, and then they took it out. The case with the Iranians, same type thing. You know, if at the moment that the Israelis, I think, who probably have better intelligence on the ground than we do with regards to Iran, when the Iranians cross that threshold, there's not going to be a whole lot that's going to stop the Israelis from taking out the entire thing.
You're an intelligence guy. Let me ask you an intelligence question. Have you read the 28 pages in the 9/11 report?
The 28 classified pages?
The redacted, yes.
I have.
Okay.
I mean, I've read both versions of the 9/11 report in detail. But,
okay.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that.
No,
here.
We can't talk about that. I know that.
Anywhere. Yeah.
You know, so, I've been trying to find Bob Graham's number all day, so if you have it, give it to me.
I do not.
But you know where I'm going. You know, Saudi Arabia has room, if you want to talk about the refugees and everything, has room for 3 million people, won't take any refugees, and won't take any responsibility for anything that's going on in the Middle East right now. I am nonplussed by that.
Well, it's the dumbest question that nobody in a position of authority seems to be asking is,
yeah,
why aren't these refugees heading east? Why aren't these refugees being welcomed into the bosom of the land of the two holy cities? You know, why aren't they? Why aren't the Saudis, who are obligated to show ultimate, you know, utmost charity to other Muslims? I mean, Muslims are obligated to show charity to one another. Why are the Saudis and the Gulf states not showing charity to the Syrian refugees?
Yeah, they'll cut their hands off if they do something wrong, but they're not going to welcome them.
It's an outstanding question.
It's messed up.
That the right people aren't asking.
That's kind of where I was going with that, is how many different conflicts do we have going on in the Middle East right now? About 70.
too many. Well, we're involved in a couple right now. It's very low signature compared to what it was in the 2002 to 2010 time frame.
Really? So it's less?
Oh, just less of a footprint on the ground. We've got less of a footprint, but yeah, we're still there. We're involved in Syria. We're involved in Iraq. We're involved in Afghanistan still.
So here's another question: why aren't we seeing any pictures of what we're doing in Syria?
We've seen video of a special operations raid. We're just not doing a lot. I mean, most of what we're doing is from the air. The other thing is, if it were my preference, we wouldn't see pictures of anything.
See, I know that's how you are.
Because I think the whole idea of having embedded media and all that stuff is just...
Yeah, I know.
We've tried that, and as good as it makes people feel...
It should make the American people feel...
That we're bringing our media along, and we're letting them see how we operate. We're letting them see that what war looks like up close, and how benevolent our soldiers are and all this stuff. It doesn't go with warfare. People at home shouldn't be seeing warfare.
Why not?
Warfare is a very ugly thing.
It is an ugly thing.
In an extremely ugly and violent way.
You don't think that people need to see that?
The whole thing becomes a media frenzy. And we wind up spending, the military winds up spending more of its time feeding the media and answering questions. It's just my opinion. I mean, I believe that war should be censored like they did in World War II. War
really?
Is nasty. War is violent. War needs to be excessively nasty and violent if you intend on winning it. Otherwise, you end up getting in some sort of conflict activity and behavior that is acceptable to the home audience and journalists. Who are going to come back, they're perfectly willing to go along for the ride.
You're worried about the judgment.
What's that?
You're worried about them judging you.
Well, absolutely. There are things in war that defy common sense. There are things in war that defy common decency. It's war. So you don't want to direct all of your energy answering questions on why you did something horrific in wartime.
I get
when
that.
War is entirely horrific.
Do you think
it either is or it isn't? There's no nice way to do warfare.
No, there isn't, and people should understand that. But do you think we're actually fighting a war right now?
In a half-ass sort of way.
Well, yeah.
No, we're not engaged in total warfare at all. I would argue that we haven't been engaged in total warfare since 9/11. What we have been doing since 9/11. In no way resembles the total war that is determined for a vanquished and defeated enemy in a positive outcome for the United States since World War II. We haven't fought a war like that. Well, Desert Storm.
Who's the enemy?
Obviously, right now, today, the enemy is...
This is a problem.
Al-Qaeda.
You're
it's
right.
ISIS. It's countries and organizations.
It's so widespread now. It's really hard to say we declare war on what?
Well, just from the standpoint, and people get hung up on this for no real good reason. I mean, it was just like after 9/11. I mean, there were geniuses in the Oval Office like Colin Powell who talked President Bush off the ledge from just going completely berserko on Afghanistan and declaring war. Thinking men and women of the federal government convinced George Bush that, well, you can't declare war against a terror group. It's too nebulous. It's not. Well, he didn't have to. He could have declared war against Afghanistan.
Okay.
Because here's the important part of war. It's not necessarily that you're just declaring war against a country or a geographic location. But what the president gets when he receives a formal declaration of war, what he gets there is a goodie bag of authorities.
Sure.
He gets the legal authority to do all sorts of things that the president cannot do on his own.
I know.
Even with an authorization for the use of military force. It's a different thing. So, yeah, I would declare war right now against Syria. And the hell with that ISIS is in Syria and Iraq. Well, listen, what we've got is a declaration of war. That doesn't mean we have to confine our activities to Syria. We declared war against Japan, but we didn't confine our activities to Japan. We confined our activities to wherever the Japanese were, even in international waters, which belonged to no one. We declared war on Germany, and we didn't confine our activities to Germany. We fought them in France. We fought them, you know, we fought the Germans in Africa, in Italy. So, you know, it doesn't really matter.
Let's step back for a second. If they had taken out Hitler, if they had just killed Hitler, how much time and money and lives would have been saved?
That's a great question, but we just don't know that. It wasn't just Hitler. It was Hitler, it was Goering, it was Himmler, it was the entire Nazi party around him.
Yeah.
Hitler would have been replaced. Now, that's not one where you could have just cut the head off the snake. In fact, if we would have killed Hitler, chances are we would have had a worse fight on our hands. Because towards the last year and a half of the war, Hitler was making so many horrendously poor decisions that went against what his generals, like Rommel, who was a genius, mm-hmm. were telling him, that one of the reasons they lost the war was because Hitler remained in power for so long. So, I mean, if we would have killed Hitler earlier, it may have been worse.
From an intelligence standpoint, you know who these leaders are. You know who this guy is that is running ISIS. You know who he is.
Doesn't matter, though.
This
is not one
of
these things where you cut the head off the snake and the whole organization just shrivels up and dies. That's not the way these groups are. It's not the way they operate, and it's not the way they're organized.
I would go kill him, and I would put it all over social media.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Why
you could kill al-Baghdadi tomorrow, and it wouldn't put a dent in ISIS operations. In fact, there would be a celebration with ISIS. They would celebrate the fact that he's a martyr and he's with Allah now.
These people are insane.
These groups don't operate like that. These groups don't take their direction and leadership from a single individual on the ground. It's simply, if that were the case, then Islam would have died 1,400 years ago. The first three successors to Muhammad.
Yeah.
Muslims believe is their prophet. The first three successors of Muhammad were killed by their successors within the first 15 years of the death of Muhammad.
This is a huge problem.
It's a huge complication. I mean, these are, you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, these are cellular organizations. If you're going to take a step back and analyze it, the beauty of the way that they operate so successfully is that they don't rely on centralized leadership. They don't rely on one brilliant leader who's telling them what to do. They get all of their direction from the Quran and from the Hadith and from Sharia law, which lays out their instructions in perfect detail.
Well, in the meantime, they're infiltrating themselves into places like Sweden and Norway.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, look at Dearborn, Michigan. This is not good.
In these days now, the assertiveness of Muslim communities in Western nations is becoming so pronounced.
It's in your face.
You don't even need ISIS in Sweden. You've got everyday run-of-the-mill Muslims in massive communities, you know, protesting and becoming violent with the Swedish government, saying that they're going to take over the country. This isn't even ISIS. These are just peace-loving Muslims who have been allowed to immigrate into these countries.
What they need in Sweden are guns. And lots of them. And I'm not a, you know me for a long time, I'm not a gun person, really.
Right.
People here are going to have to arm themselves.
Well, in groups like this, I mean, this is the one country, thank God, if we retain our right to arm ourselves, where any armed invader, whether it's, you know, ISIS or anybody else, they're going to have a rude awakening when they come into the United States in a serious way and, you know, think that they're just going to take over through armed action. I mean, because not only do we have a very well-armed populace, but our everyday average police departments, you know, people complain about the militarization of our police force.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at what happened in San Bernardino,
mm-hmm.
that wasn't the FBI and it wasn't Delta Force or SEAL Team 6. That was the San Bernardino City Police Department and San Bernardino Sheriff's Department that took those people down. A lot of people outside this country underestimate how well-equipped, trained, and armed just our everyday average police departments are. So it's a different story. In most of those cases, you know, Sweden, Germany, France, their police departments are nationalized. That creates, I think it creates certain command and control problems when you get into a localized area.
The only problem here is they're making it really hard to buy ammunition.
From a guy who likes to go to the range and shoot, I'm telling you, it's getting it's expensive.
I know.
Yeah, it's getting crazy.
And I don't know much about this. I really don't. But from what I've seen over the last couple of weeks, it's not that they're trying to regulate your ability to buy a gun, but your ability to buy bullets.
The federal government over the last couple of years has tried several things. I mean, they tried to make it very difficult, if not impossible, to buy, you know, 5.56 NATO standard round ammunition for AR-15s and stuff. And, you know, thank God we've got the National Rifle Association.
You are so badass.
Who is all over this stuff. And they stopped that from happening.
Yeah. I mean, I know people who have compiled like 500,000 rounds because they're worried about being able to buy it.
Yeah, no, it's getting tough.
We really appreciate your time. I know you have stuff you have to do today. I appreciate you taking the time to shed some light on, it's not just a religious zealot thing. It's a real ongoing problem.
Well, this is one of the things that I try to tell people, Elizabeth, who get up in arms over some of the things that, say, Donald Trump has said. And I kind of get up in arms, not necessarily because he said, well, we need to put a temporary moratorium on all Muslims coming into the country until we figure it out. What he and his team have not done well is articulated that if Islam were just a religion, the only thing Islam were about was praying five times a day, fasting once a year, celebrating Eid, doing the Hajj, you know, showing charity, people wouldn't care. You know, people say, hey, there's not going to be a religious test. Well, that's great. Islam is not just a religion.
It's a violent religion.
Religion is only one piece of what Islam is.
You and I have not even talked about the Benghazi thing and the Christopher guy and what happened to him. I see that this is a violent religion.
The religious aspect of Islam isn't, I mean, if you were to strip out all the violent stuff, you'd pretty much be left with, you know, different version of Judaism. But Islam, by its own admission, is not just a religion. Islam, to anybody who understands Islam as a force, is a political system. It's a sociological system. All of Islam compiled is a holistic system that controls governance, society, the legal system, and religion. And they call the whole thing a religion. It would be like calling the United States, or let's say Italy, is a Catholic country. That would be like calling all of Italy a religion, because it's a Catholic country. This is what people do not understand about Islam.
So it's an entity.
It mystifies me. It's never brought up.
Well, they want to sit here and be all politically correct about it. And while I'm one of the most moderate people you could ever talk to, even I see that this is not acceptable.
Yeah, the question needs to be asked of the Muslim community. If you can explain, let's open the Sharia law books, let's open Reliance of the Traveler, let's open the Hadith, let's open the Tafsir, let's open all of these things, the Muwatta of Ibn Malik, all of these books that direct from God and Muhammad the way all of civilization is to conduct its life, not just religion, but the temporal aspects of life, law, governance, society, and that's all part of Islam. You let's take that. Let's strip out all of the religious stuff, right? Prayer, fasting, boom. And we'll say, okay, this is Islam. This is the religion. All of this other crap that's in there that tells people how they're supposed to go to the bathroom, how they're supposed to wash their hands, how they're supposed to rule their people, how they're supposed to punish, how they're supposed to govern, how they're supposed to interact with non-Muslims. We're going to take all of that out. And we're going to call that politics. We're going to call that a political system and a governance system. And that's not allowed. You want to pray, you want to fast, you want to go to Friday prayers and pray five times a day and be charitable, then we're going to allow you to call that the religion of Islam. All of this other nonsense is, by any standard, international standard or acceptable standard in the world today, is unacceptable as a system of governance, and you can figure out what to do with it. But we're not letting it in here.
I hate to say this, because I'm a Catholic, and I don't believe in killing people, but we have to, you know, do something about these people.
Well, there's only one force in the history of humanity that has confronted Islam spiritually and temporally, and that is the Catholic Church. And right now, the Catholic Church is showing zero leadership in the face of its own people being slaughtered by the thousands in the Middle East.
I know. What the hell is that?
Well, that's because since the Second Vatican Council, the Catholic Church has become a hippie organization that believes okay. that it's going to conduct itself in the world, you know, by giving hugs and understanding everything and creating a moral and spiritual equivalency of every other system outside of the Catholic Church. So it's done nothing but confuse itself and its role in the world.
It's rather surprising to me that they haven't taken a bigger stand. But I think in your capable hands, this will change, hopefully, sometime soon.
Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence, but unless I won the president for a month raffle at the annual church picnic, we're pretty far from that.
Thank you so much for your time, Frank, and you're always amazing to have on the program.
Well, I appreciate that, and I wish you guys a very, very Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
And a peaceful New Year, as much as we can hope for one.
Keep up with us during the week. Listen to show highlights and daily memos and more. Just follow Elizabeth on Twitter, keyword Doherty Report.